You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan. On today's show...
I accept that my remarks could have been clearer in that respect, and I'm glad to provide this clarification.
The UK Foreign Secretary's big mouth might have endangered a British citizen being held in Iran. We ask whether Boris Johnson is up to the job and assess the state of UK politics more broadly. My guests, Marie Bion and Robin Lustig, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including France has spoken out against a system of tax havens revealed by the Paradise Papers. But what can they, or anyone else, really do about it? A century after the Bolshevik Revolution, we check in to see how Russia's coping with its own history. All that, plus a controversy over gender and language in France. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Henry Rees-Sheridan. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Robin Lustig, a journalist and broadcaster, and Marie Bion, UK correspondent for French media. Welcome both to the programme. The UK's Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, has often grabbed headlines for his careless, at times downright offensive way with words. Now, the UK's top diplomat is back in the spotlight for making inaccurate comments thought to pose a danger to a British national being held in Iran. Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe is currently serving a five-year term for allegedly plotting to topple the Iranian government, though the specific charges against her have never been made public. Johnson was forced to clarify his comments today, which were criticised as being possibly at risk of being used by the Iranian authorities to increase Zaghari Ratcliffe's sentence. It's the latest gaffe from Johnson at a time when the UK standing overseas, not least thanks to Brexit, is diminishing. Robin, I'll begin with you. I don't want to get too bogged down in Zaghari Ratcliffe's case, but what does this latest gaffe reveal about Boris Johnson's MO? And is he really the best person for this job?
It reveals that Boris Johnson is not just a clown, which is the traditional view of him. Oh, Boris is Boris, that kind of thing. Don't take him too seriously. It's all jolly japes. It's fine. It's actually not fine. This man is the Foreign Secretary. What he says is taken very seriously. If he says something which is carelessly worded, or which, as in this case, is plain wrong, it has serious consequences. In this particular case, it has serious consequences for a British citizen incarcerated in Iran. In other circumstances, for example, Britain's negotiations over leaving the European Union, when he has more than once taken a public position at variance with the Prime Minister's, it serves to confuse the issue, it serves to weaken Britain overseas, it makes Britain look not just a laughingstock, which is a point did right from the beginning, but it looks like a country whose government is dysfunctional. And if you are in very serious negotiations about the future relationship between Britain and the EU, to have what people think is a dysfunctional government is a very serious issue.
Boris Johnson is responsible for his own words and actions, but Theresa May, as the head of the government he's part of, is also responsible in part for his words and actions. Are his gaffes a question, at least in part, of a lack of cabinet discipline from her?
Oh, very much so. I mean, the fact that he is still the Foreign Secretary is, I think, an absolutely indisputable sign that she is fatally weak. Any other Prime Minister in any other circumstances would have sacked Boris Johnson, not because of what he said in this particular case, but because of what he said before the Conservative Party conference when he wrote an article which was seriously different from what the government's official view was about the Brexit negotiations. That was an act of disloyalty. It was seen at the time, I think rightly, as an act designed to buttress his position as the leader in waiting for when Theresa May falls. That is not a tolerable thing for a foreign secretary to do. Yes, she is weak. Yes, he is a danger. He should have gone.
Robin, you know, we've got a weakened and divided government handling the monumental challenge of Brexit. Conservative and Labour MPs now being investigated for sexual misconduct. For many, Boris Johnson is only the most visible emblem of the tragicomic state of British politics in general. Is it as bad as it seems?
I think in anything it's even worse. I don't think I can remember a British government which was in more disarray, a British Prime Minister who was as weak as this Prime Minister. Let's remember, this is a woman who inherited her job when David Cameron walked away after losing a referendum that he thought he was bound to win. She then called a totally unnecessary general election, thinking that it would strengthen her position in Parliament. In fact, it wiped out her party's majority. This is a woman who has no political credibility, who has no political authority in her own cabinet. The doctrine of cabinet responsibility, under which British ministers are meant always to toe the government line, even if in private they disagree with it, has totally broken down. I can't think of another occasion when we have had such a weak prime minister or government.
When you look across the channel, other European governments have their fair share of problems themselves. Do we really compare so unfavourably to them?
I think we do, yes. I think genuinely, with the possible exception of Spain at the moment with the Catalan issue, which of course is of immense seriousness, the UK is now weaker in terms of its overseas reputation, in terms of its diplomatic clout, than it has been for a very long time indeed. A lot of British political commentators think back to the days of John Major, who was the Prime Minister in the early 1990s. He led a weak government, which was eventually put out of its misery by Tony Blair and the Labour Party, who swept to power in 1997. Theresa May's government, I think, Theresa May's own position, is actually worse than John Major's was then.
Murray, I want to put that to you too, as a European. Does the British government really look that shambolic in comparison to other governments on the continent?
Well, seen from the continent, yeah, he doesn't look good at all. I can't count how many times I had to talk about on one of my radio stations I'm working for. Theresa May has had a bad week, she had a bad day, so we're talking a lot about that. And of course, it's not well and perfect, even in France. I mean, the new president is more and more unpopular, so it's not all smooth sailing. But nowhere is there a head of the government who should basically be elsewhere but can't go anywhere else because there's no one to take over. So there's the shambolic phase of it, and there's also the thing that there's no one to replace her if she has to go indeed, and it's more and more complicated because she can't go. So yeah, I think it's very particular what's happening at the moment. It's very interesting from France because we normally have a lot of problem in government, and even at the moment with a rookie president we could have a lot of things going a bit wrong, but what's happening in the UK is basically a good spreadsheet of what should not be done. So it's a good example of what to avoid, I guess.
Marie, sticking with you, what do you think the EU's leaders make of all of this? The UK must look like easy prey to exploit to get a Brexit deal favourable to them.
Yes, but I really don't think that's the state of mind of the EU. Yes, at the start, there was some resentment towards the UK because of Brexit and what it does to the EU. But I think the EU knows, or most of the representatives of the EU, not all of them perhaps, but most of them know that being seen as the bigger man, basically the one who smoothed the angles, is quite important because some Brexiters wanted Brexit to trigger the end of the EU. Some people said very clearly, I think it should be the end of the EU. That's just the first basically stone to the unification of the EU. What the EU wants is that this precisely doesn't happen, and it's the onus is on them basically for that not to happen. So although the UK government is weak, I mean, as the EU is quite strong in terms of economy, in terms of politics, some things are going wrong, of course, but it's quite strong at the moment. It's very important that they don't look like, you know, the big lion going onto the weak lamb.
But what the message one keeps hearing from Brussels over Brexit in particular, addressed to London, is tell us what it is you want and then we'll talk about it. And that's the one thing that the British government can't do, because they can't come up with a single line about what it is they want. They all want different things. And that, I have the impression, is deeply frustrating to the rest of the UK's EU partners, because they know they need to negotiate a way out of this and they haven't got anybody making any sense in London.
Robin, before we move on, I want to ask you, you've been observing UK politics for a long time. Where's the hope? Where's the young political talent in the UK? What do they look like and what are they doing?
There is young political talent in Westminster. A lot of them are very inexperienced still. I wouldn't really like to throw them into the hot seat at the moment because, I mean, let's be honest, any political leader at the moment dealt the hand of cards that Theresa May was dealt would have a really tough job. This ain't easy for anybody. So there are young politicians, there's a new generation of politicians who will one day be ready to take the reins. I don't think they're ready yet. I think Britain at the moment is in a really bad place politically.
Moving on now, the Paradise Papers, a vast cache of documents released on Sunday detailing the tax and finance arrangements of some of the world's most privileged earners, continue to shed light on how the wealthy store their money and avoid tax. France has been quick to condemn tax dodgers, with Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire this week calling for tax havens to be stripped of any benefits currently enjoyed by members of financial organisations such as the IMF or the World Bank. But would a measure like this do any good, or would it just push crafty accountants into ever more opaque and murky business dealings? Marie, let's start with you. You're from Monaco, itself a glamorous tax haven, but you work for French media. Does it surprise you that France has spoken out so strongly about this?
Not really, because at the moment the government wants to be seen as white and white, and Europe is already a good playing field for a government who's having problems at home. So it's basically gold on the plate that's been given to the French government at the moment. And we know in France we had some issues with ministers who had dodgy tax account in Swiss. So it's very important for France to be seen as whiter than white. And the fact that, yes, it is indeed the French who's... wants to be seen at least as giving the impulsion to being tougher against tax havens. They're being tougher towards Monaco. Of course, it's a very close neighbour to them, and things are changing over there. And I haven't read that it's supposed to be perhaps on this blacklist that Bruno Le Maire wants to establish. So they want to lead the way, and they say that the OECD list that exists at the moment is, I think there's just one or two countries in it. So they want to basically have a blacklist that's more officially made, more thoroughly investigated, so that this blacklist can really be a government sheet, basically, something that government can really rely on to say these are the bad states that we should do something about. And this, the information would give them the permission to try and do something against tax haven. So the idea of Bruno Le Maire is to cut them from EU funds, IMF, and the World Bank. Is it a good idea? I'm not a specialist of economics to be able to say that. There will be a very strong thing to do. I don't know how that would impact the local economy.
Robin, the organisations that help the super rich dodge tax are sought after precisely because of their ability to exploit loopholes in tax systems. Do you think it's even possible for international governments to work together to close these loopholes? And do they want to?
Well, those are two very good questions. I think... is it possible for them to close loopholes? Probably not, because it's a truism, I think, that all the best accountants and best lawyers don't work for governments. So the people trying to hide their money will always have better advice than the people who are trying to stop them hiding their money. Do they want to? Well, I have my doubts. I think they could have done much, much more than they've done over a period of several years. They know, however, that some of the biggest donors to political parties are tax avoiders who use some of these offshore havens. They know that some of the biggest multinational corporations, whose head offices they want, whose good wishes they want, also use similar devices. They fear, I suspect, that if they clamp down too hard, it will damage a particular country's economic prospects and its business climate. I happen to think they're wrong. What makes me most angry about all this is that the taxes that these people aren't paying could be used to build homes, to provide better salaries for nurses, for teachers, to hire more people, to offer care to older people. This is money that could be put to good use. It's money that's being siphoned away to make rich people richer and poor people poorer.
Marie, what's your read on the public response to the Paradise Papers? There's anger, but I don't get the sense that a revolution is on the doorstep. Is it difficult to get angry or to form a political movement about something so complicated?
That's the thing. That's really the thing. That it is so complicated. And not only is it complicated, it's not illegal per se, and that's quite important. People who would like to, I don't know, have a discussion, a heated discussion about it around the beer or around the coffee in France, would basically be a bit at loss at some point to say what they have against this in terms of very particular example. It's more the philosophy of it, and the philosophy of it is quite complex because yes, of course, people want to pay less taxes. And maybe, indeed, surely, if those people pay all the taxes they were due in the UK, maybe the smaller people, basically the normal people, would have less taxes to pay. But that's very complicated. That's you can rant about rich people who can just, you know, go away and have their taxes reduced by that. But it's difficult to have a big conversation. And there are so many things that were worse. For example, when there's really tax evasion, it's something that people get angry about. But still, it's so complicated. So at some point, if you can't really get angry about something that's illegal, what's the point of getting angry of something that's legal, basically?
There's another reason, I think, why there isn't more anger. I suspect there are an awful lot of people who will either say in the pub or certainly think to themselves, if I had £10 million, I'd certainly be trying to pay as little tax on it as I could. So there's a little bit of sneaking, let's say, understanding, even admiration,
and
people who manage to get away with it.
Robin, sticking with you and zooming out a little bit, this is investigative journalism at its best, isn't it, this leak?
It is. I am hugely impressed by the work that has been done, because what's happened is that millions and millions of documents have been leaked. It has taken, as I understand it, a year to sift through them, to make sense of them, to see what the story is that they tell. It has taken journalists, hundreds of journalists, in many, many different countries to cooperate. The fact that they are able to do this, it is a real example of what good journalism should be doing, what good journalism can do. It's very expensive. This has taken up a lot of journalists' time, and they need to be paid. What worries me most is that there will be less and less of this kind of journalism if more people aren't prepared to pay for their news. If they just get it free online, it ain't gonna happen.
Marie, you were nodding along to that. You agree?
Absolutely, yes. It's something that we see less and less in the media at the moment. Putting money into journalists' time that don't see anything concrete very quickly. And that's something that's all the more important now in this area of fake news and all that. And the fact that there's good in the bad of the fake news, because I think more and more people understand the value of journalism. And this kind of, maybe not the people, but there's something philosophical now about journalism that people get a bit, that it's important to be informed. And if you want to just say, I don't care about that, that's okay, it's there. And the fact that media are willing to put that much money, that much time, is I think, something I think it's just very commendable.
Well, you're listening to Midori House here with me, Henry Rhys Sheridan, Marie Bion and Robin Lustig. Coming up next, the Russian Revolution 100 years on and a scuffle over inclusive language in France.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
You're listening to Midori House. Still with me are Robin Lustig and Marie Bion. Today marks 100 years since the Bolsheviks, led by Vladimir Lenin, gained power in Russia in a revolution that established communist rule for the next 70 years, up to the end of the Cold War. Vladimir Putin is not publicly commemorating the event, and you can understand why Russia's longest-serving leader since Stalin might be sheepish about celebrating a mass uprising. But not even he can prevent the shadow of the Soviet era from looming over the Russian story. Robin, beginning with you, you broadcast live from Moscow on the last day of the Soviet Union. What was the state of Russia's collective memory then, and how has it changed since?
Well, it was divided then. It is divided now. The thing about Russia, and I'm not a Russia expert, although I have reported from there many times, the thing about Russia is that there are still, even now, a lot of people who think back quite fondly to the communist era. Because let's think about it. The USSR was a superpower. It was a major nuclear power. It looked the United States in the eye as an equal. And that it provided basic housing and education and healthcare for its workers. It didn't offer any freedom. It offered the gulags. It offered the execution squads of Stalin. It was a grim time for those who were politically active. It was less grim for those who weren't interested in politics. My recollection of those final days of the Soviet Union was that there were huge numbers of people who were excited about what the new era would bring, a new era of freedom and openness. There were others, particularly older people, who were worried, who were apprehensive, who wondered what it was they had lost. And I think that still applies today.
Marie, how does Vladimir Putin fit into all this? In him, does Russia have its Tsar back, as some are saying? And what does he make of his country's history, as far as you can tell?
Well, I was struck very recently about the fact that Putin is not someone who's parting of this debate at the moment on what to do with the corpse of Lenin, who's still not been buried for 90 years almost after he died. And he is not one of those who wants to dwell on this issue. But I think it's very symbolic of this holding on to this era. You can still see today the corpse of one of the most violent leader of the modern era in Russia, and it's still revered, and it's still so much money put into just you know, preserving this body. And it's they have 200 scientists, I think, working on this mausoleum project, I think it's called. And I think it's very telling that there still can be a debate about should we bury Lenin now. It means should we bury the past or not somehow. And the fact that Putin doesn't want to weigh in very heavily on that means that he wants to play on both sides. Yes, of course, I mean, he doesn't want to have the kind of popular uprising there were for that put Lenin basically on the power, because he's a very repressive leader and he doesn't like the people to do what they want. But at the same time, he wants to keep, I think, this imagination that there's still a bit of the USSR in the Putin's regime, because he's still, I mean, Russia, the modern Russia, is quite young, and Putin was into the USSR, so he might be the last leader to be able to do that, but he wants to keep this link, I think.
He is, in this sense, I think, a very accurate representative of the people whom he leads. His own ambivalence in the remarks he's made around this anniversary, I do think, actually accurately reflect the ambivalence of a large number of Russian people. He's not quite sure what to make of the fact that there is a communist past. He's not a communist, he's not a revolutionary, but he knows that there was something about it that made Russia something that some Russians, at least, many Russians, were proud of.
Robin, sticking with you, with the far-right resurgent across Europe, are other European nations as well reconciled to their past as they might like to think?
What you need as a nation to be reconciled to your past is a unified view about what that past represents. The best example, of course, is Germany, which has come to terms with its Nazi past because, with the exception of a small minority, Germans know that that was an appalling episode for which they should always feel deep shame. And they do, by and large. Other countries are less lucky in having that unified view of their past. Ask an average Brit what they think about Britain's record as an imperial nation, and you won't get a unified view. Ask the people of Ireland what they think about their country's past. You won't get a unified view. Most European nations are relatively young as unified nations. I remember being in Italy on the
I think it was 175th anniversary of the unification of Italy. And I talked to people in the south of Italy who still felt that they had been invaded and conquered by North Italians. They still harked back to the days of the Kingdom of Sicily and Naples. So there are many, many countries where people still have very divided views about their past. And in a sense, I think that's healthy. People should always debate and discuss their past because it helps them better to chart a future.
Marie, ending with you and very briefly, what are Russia's options after Putin? We've discussed the country's past, but what about its future?
I have to say I'm not sure about that.
It's a tough question.
It's a very tough question for someone who follows France and the UK, but I'll try anyhow. Is there really a will? I've talked to a lot of friends who are from Russia, who study Russia, and they all tell me Russian people want to have a strong hand at the helm. So they will, I think, go towards a strong hand to succeed to Putin, when someone can succeed to Putin without being a puppet. And I'm not sure if there's someone in particular. Again, I'm not in the know. I'm not sure if there's someone in particular. But at the moment, and we've seen that for some time, Putin is trying to edge away those who would perhaps hold the democracy, accusing them of many things, of illegal things, basically. So he wants to get rid of that. So in a way, he's thinking about what's after him. I'm not sure there's someone in particular that he's is grooming at the moment.
Nearly time to say goodbye, but we're going to finish in France, where the Académie Française, the nation's authority on language, has recently voiced concern about gender-neutral terms. Unlike English, many words are pronounced differently in French depending on what gender they've been assigned. I got a D in my French high school exam, but luckily we have francophone Marie Bion to defer to. Marie, tell us exactly what the Académie Française is getting wound up about.
So, the Académie Française doesn't want language to change, basically. At the moment, until very recently, we had an ambassador who was a lady, a French ambassador. But when people were called in for lunch or anything, the crier would say, l'ambassadeur est servi, and not the ambassadress. It's the ambassador, it's the man. The ambassadress is the feminine. But you would use the male title because that's the official title. L'ambassadrice is the wife of the ambassador. It's not the title. And the mayoress of Paris, for example, is not the mayoress of Paris. She's le maire of Paris. It's a masculine title. And they don't want the feminization of the title, saying it's not a question of being misogyny or anything. It's just that the right way of saying things for years and years is the masculine way. Masculine always prevail on feminine in terms of orthograph and many other things. And they wanted to keep it that way. But that also means, of course, that at the moment, we have young pupils who are studying, who are being groomed to thinking that it's better to be a man to be mayor of a country, to be mayor of a city, than being a woman. Because if you're a woman, you still have the title of a man. And some school books decided that they would present the two possibilities. And the Académie Française is very, very not happy about that.
Robin, I will come to you before we go. I can see you're keen to speak, but I just want to absolutely establish what exactly is really at stake here. Why is the Académie Française getting so het up about this? Actually, Robin, maybe you do have an insight.
Well, no, let Marie answer that, because I want to answer yours.
I think the Académie Française has been around since 1635, I think. It's the institution that codifies the French language. It's the authority codifying the French language. And they say we have to keep the French language as it is because people reveal around the world the French language. If we change it, we're going to lose what's special in here. And he doesn't want to adapt because the adaptation is letting go of a revered past. That's exactly what's happening. The problem, I think, in France, very quickly, is that not that this academy exists. It's good that it exists, that someone wants to keep things as they are. It's the importance that we give to this academy. It's good that they say what they have to say. We don't have to listen to them.
I love the French language. I love listening to the French language. I love speaking the French language. But the absurdity of the Académie Française is really beyond description. Language always changes. It has to change. It's organic. The absurdity of gender in grammar. L'addition, the French name for a bill or a cheque, is feminine. La cuenta in Spanish is feminine. In Italian, il conto is masculine. I mean, There's no logic to that. It's bonkers. It's crazy. Get rid of it. Let people themselves decide how they speak the language, what language they speak. The Académie Française should be put out of its misery.
On that note, it brings us to the end of today's show. Robin Lustig and Marie Bion, thanks very much for joining us here at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tasha Kleeman. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music next, and at 1900 hours, it's Section D with yours truly. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's at 1800 London time. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. Goodbye.